underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Before Alexandria Marzano-Usnovich begins a summer job at a law firm in Louisiana, working on the retrial defense of convicted murderer and child molester Ricky Langley, she thinks her position is clear. The child of two lawyers, she is staunchly opposed to the death penalty. But the moment she hears Ricky speak of his crimes, she is overcome with the feeling of wanting him to die. Shocked by her reaction, she digs deeper into the case and is forced to confront her own family's long-buried secrets and to reckon with how her own past colors her view of the crime. Alexandria brings us to question how we understand our past and the nature of forgiveness. The title of the book is The Fact of a Body, a Murder, and a Memoir, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Alexandria Marzano-Usnovich to The Book Show this week. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It is an honor and a thrill to be here.
Well, I'm very happy that you are here. I know this has been in the works for a long time for you, almost a decade. So at what point do the stars align and do you say, okay, now is the time for me to start putting the pieces together?
Very, very late. The book interweaves the stories of Ricky Langley, the victim, Jeremy Guillory, his family, and my own family. And because of that, I had a lot of moving parts to think about. The book moves back and forth in time. And there were a lot of pieces, and I was writing a lot of condensed versions. I would write these 100-page condensed versions that interwove the parts just to try to figure out that interweaving. And the pieces didn't really snap into place until 2015, which was 5 years in.
When you first hear of this case, you are very young. You are 25 years old. It seems to me then that it sort of takes you a while to deconstruct and figure all of this stuff out, especially when you're investigating this case.
Very much so. So when I first learned about the case, and I actually did not work on it, I was not there to defend him, but I was shown his confession videotape. That was the first thing that happened when I began to work for this death penalty defense firm. And in watching that tape and listening to him describe what he had done to children, I felt time collapse. I felt my own past come back to me. And that I had such a strong emotional response raised all these unresolved questions inside me, and led to, frankly, years of being haunted by it. I didn't go back to Louisiana to begin to reinvestigate it until many years had passed, and I had had to live with that inside me and just thought, well, okay, I'm going to have to figure out what actually happened in this case so that I can put it to rest inside me. That's what I thought was going on. I thought I was going to put it to rest inside me.
It is, and I guess that's what I meant by working on the case, because you then collect, there's just this trove of documents, and you start going through all of this paperwork regarding the case, all of the transcripts, everything. You start going through very painstakingly, and yes, the goal for you originally was just to figure this out for you.
It was. I'm very passionately opposed to the death penalty, and I believe very strongly in the law. And my idea of the law was that to be a good attorney would mean that I would have to be able to leave my past behind me and respond to the case just as the case. Respond to defending Ricky just by looking at him and seeing Ricky Langley, seeing who he was. And yet, whenever I thought about the murder, what I thought about was my own past. So I really thought that what I was doing when I got that first set of files, I ultimately ended up working off of about 30,000 pages of court records, but I began with 8,000. And what I thought I was doing when I got them was that I was finally going to be able to put that down, like I said. And what happened instead was that reading them, I started to realize that I wasn't alone in seeing my life in this case. That, in fact, I felt reading these files that the lawyer, I read of him talking often about his father, and I read of the judge having an emotional response based on his past. And when I spoke with the jury foreman, he had an emotional response based on his past and his family. And I started to realize that that was actually what I needed to think about and look at.
Do you think that that is a commonality, not only in this case, but in cases in general where we look at them through our own lens?
I think it's a commonality of being human, you know, of having an emotional response. And it's a commonality of empathy, even. When we look at a case like that, murder, there's no way to see that and not feel emotionally affected, I think. And when we feel emotionally affected, it's because we're identifying with something. And I think that very often how we interpret it has to do with the life we've lived, has to do with what our perspective is.
And that humanity can be both a blessing and a curse to the legal system.
Absolutely. In some cases, it meant that people found more empathy for Ricky. In some cases, it meant that they found less empathy for Ricky.
So let's back up just for a moment. And I would like you, because you do it beautifully in the book, but I would like for you to describe the reaction that you had to the case, of how that changed you, of what it was about the case and hearing the voice that stayed with you and allowed it to become an obsession.
So I had grown up being sexually abused by my grandfather.
Right.
And that was widespread in my family. He abused my sisters as well. And we never, ever spoke of it. It was a big taboo topic. And as a child, the way that children do, I think, children learn the rules of their family. And I learned and felt the silence deep inside me. And so later on, as I got older, those memories began to affect me quite deeply. And I had all this emotional turmoil about it and nowhere to put that. And part of what I think led me to the law, I mean, I'm intellectually fascinated by the law and I believe in it deeply. But also part of what led me to it was this idea that it was a space more of reason than of emotion. And I found that idea deeply comforting. And so when I entered law school, I think I thought also that I would be getting away from the past, that I would be leaving these messy emotions that were deep inside me behind. And I would have a life that sort of would look very outwardly successful and would start anew in some ways. And then I get to Louisiana to begin what I thought would be my life and my career path and what was certainly my passion. And the very first thing that happens is that I'm shown this tape. And as I watch this tape, the words that Ricky Langley used, and I will note that sometimes when I talk of him now, I say Ricky Langley, and sometimes I say Ricky. And it seems I've lived with the idea of this man for so long in my mind and in my soul, really, that I think it shifts based on the emotional reaction I'm having at that moment, which is just a strange thing to observe about myself as a writer and a person. But so I was watching that tape, and he began to describe what he had done to children and the pleasure that he took in it. And some of the words he used for what he had done actually mirrored exactly what had been done to me as a child. And all of a sudden, it became so abundantly clear that I couldn't get away from the past. The past was right there, coming right at me.
Right.
I felt so powerfully in that moment that I wanted Ricky Langley to die for what he had done. And that represented a real challenge to me. Because I know the moment that I learned about the death penalty when I was a child. It is one of my strongest childhood memories, and it set the direction of my life. I had gone to law school wanting to fight the death penalty. So to suddenly be faced with the very first case, the very first real life example, and to feel so strongly that I wanted him to die, I couldn't shake that collision. That collision haunted me for many years. And in fact, for years afterward, details of the murder would come back to me, details of the confession that he'd given, little details that he'd said in that confession would kind of come back to me unbidden and haunt me. And yet something very curious happened. In that moment, I would try to think of his name, Ricky Langley. And for years, I couldn't remember that name. I remembered everything that he'd done that I'd listened to him describe on the tape, and yet I couldn't remember his name. And I think that lack of memory, that way that my subconscious, it wasn't a lack of memory, really. It was a forcible shutting off, a forcible shoving out. I think my subconscious was trying to protect something. Someone once said to me, resistance protects something very precious. And I think my subconscious was kind of balking at this collision that was happening. And so that stayed inside me for years until it became impossible for me to ignore. And I had to begin to research this case.
Two observations in what you just said and in reading the book. One is that given that it was the first case, I guess it's somewhat surprising that you didn't encounter something like it through your law school experience. But also, to follow that up, that it would, if it wasn't that case, it's probably inevitable that it would have been perhaps another case that would have triggered that.
I think so, very much. And I think one of the things you read in the book is that actually there were many times before that when I tried to get away from my past. And there was always something that was happening. I mean, sexual abuse, sexual assault, both of those things pop up a lot. Or just as a woman moving through the world, sometimes you feel not so safe. And that would always bring back the memories. It's just that I, prior to that point, had always been able to flee them. And I will say that in law school, actually, the week before this happened, it's not in the book, but the week before this happened was a famous test at Harvard, where I was at law school, where you take this exam. I don't remember how long it lasts. I want to say 48 hours, but that might not be right, to try to get on law review. And you write about these cases, and you don't know what it's going to be about beforehand. But I showed up to take that test, to get my packet, and I opened it, and it was entirely sexual abuse cases. It was entirely cases of children that had been molested. And so I agree. Definitely the past kept shoving its face at me in, you know, in other moments. But I will say that those cases were on paper. There was a layer of abstraction between myself and what had happened in them.
It's hearing the voice.
It was in the voice. It was in the voice, and it was in the visual, because I was watching him. I was watching a video recording of him.
I find it fascinating that the voice stays with you, and you can hear that so clearly, although there were moments during this that you couldn't think of the name.
Yes. I think hauntings work in strange ways.
Yeah.
The subconscious clings to details that are kind of not the expected details. Charles Baxter has this amazing essay on defamiliarization in his book of craft essays, Burning Down the House. And he talks about this idea that what we're actually haunted by is often the stray detail. For so many years, I was haunted by the color blue. And I knew that it was because Ricky Lingley had wrapped Jeremy Guillory in a blue blanket after killing him.
Mm-hmm.
But I couldn't really explain why blue would be the thing that haunted me. There were so many details in the murder that, frankly, would have seemed more obvious choices to haunt me. And yet the color blue kept coming back to me. It wasn't until years later that I really thought about how much that same shade of blue had been an element of my own childhood. My favorite teddy bear was that exact color. And then I think it clicked something in my subconscious.
So does that become what we would say is repressed in and just shoved down deep inside of you, that perhaps, not to say that it would have, but perhaps would have been more to the surface and more in your understanding had your parents been more supportive in the sense of understanding what you had been through?
I think my parents, to their credit, felt that it might be possible to just move on from these events. As long as we didn't acknowledge them, as long as we didn't talk about them, they might just disappear. And I say to their credit because I really think that helped them survive it and helped, in some ways, keep the family together. I grew up with my grandfather as part of my life. That was actually very complicated for me emotionally, as you can imagine. But it did kind of keep us together. And so I did grow up with this idea of, you're right, suppression, suppression, suppression. And I want to both honor it as a survival tactic and also acknowledge that to me, yes, it did make me quite haunted. It did keep a lot of things in the realm of the unsayable. And it's often the unsayable, I think, that haunts us.
Alexandria Marzano-Lesnovich is the author of The Fact of a Body, a Murder and a Memoir, and the book is published by Flatiron Books. One of the points that you make, and I find it fascinating, is that the trial of Ricky Lingley is so simple. It's a very simple trial. It would not make a good Law and Order. And yet, the backstory and your story is so complex.
Part of what I was really struck by in law school, and then even more struck by when I got the files for this case, was how much the legal record leaves out and how much the story that emerges through the legal record, the verdict, if you will, depends on what's admitted into that courtroom. So Ricky Langley was tried 3 times over 20 years. And let's just talk about the first and second trials. In the first trial, he was sentenced to death very quickly.
Right.
In the second trial, he was given life. Both trials were about the same event, the same crime. But I think one of the big things that happened was that different things were admitted at those two trials. And so the story was told differently. And to me, what's become clear is that, yes, we often think of the law as a truth-finding mechanism. We think of a trial as a truth-finding mechanism. But just as often, it's a truth-making mechanism. It makes a story out of what happened in the past.
There's one of these trials where the judge keeps leaving the room.
Yes.
Why? Do you know ever get to the bottom of that, of what the reasoning was? Was it because of the nature of the trial itself?
Based on what he said on the record, based on all the emotional outbursts, basically, that he had at those moments, I do think it was the nature of the trial. From the beginning of voir dire, from the beginning of the jury selection process, he talked about how much this case haunted him, how much this case bothered him. He would tell the jurors, I know you don't want to be here. I don't want to be here either. Nobody wants to be here. He would talk about how at night he would need to drink to forget the images of the day.
Mm.
He talked quite openly on the record in a way that is rare, but also isn't. And I would say one of the things I've learned reading legal records is that there are all these sort of stray traces in the records that kind of never get brought to light about the way that cases impact people emotionally and about the role that emotions play in the legal process. I think that one of the things we don't acknowledge about our criminal justice system is how much subjectivity is built into it.
You write, as you mentioned, of course, the abuse by your grandfather, the relationship that then brings between you and your parents, seeing your grandfather abuse your sister, and you also tackle your coming out, and to see those all related to one another, and from reading the book, for the first time, really seeing those as all related.
Yes, absolutely. You know, on the drive here, I was thinking about a book I used to love in law school, a novel called The Archivist by Martha Cooley. And it contains this line, with enough effort, anything can be shown to connect to anything else. Existence is infinitely cross-referenced. And you know,
That's good.
Right? Right? It's fantastic.
That's very good.
And until this afternoon, quite frankly, until thinking about it on the drive, I had never connected how much I loved and needed those two sentences when I was in law school. And the way that in the book now, a lot of what I was doing was sifting through those layers, sifting through those connections. When I first set about trying to write these memories down and trying to write down what I saw in Ricky Langley's story from the files, one of my big challenges was that I felt that they're all connected. I just had this subconscious sense that there was kind of an understory, a subterranean connection understory going on here. And a lot of figuring out how to tell the story and how to structure the book was figuring out how to bring that to light for the reader in a way that would make them feel the connections.
You write in the book, I'm gay because I love women. It's as simple as that. Meaning that you were worried that people would assume that what you went through was the cause of your sexuality.
Not just worried. One of the things I can tell you, you know, if I may speak for half a second on behalf of the lesbian community.
Please do.
Any of us who are sexually abused are told that all the time.
Yeah.
And I, you know, it's so offensive to me because, I, you know, as a person can read in the book, I spent a really long time in that closet. It took me many years to come out.
It was prolonged.
It
was prolonged.
It was prolonged. And it wasn't that I didn't know I was gay. I had known I was gay for a very long time. But it was really painful to have to confront this idea that I shouldn't be who I was, or this idea that it might be due to something that had happened to me and not an essential part of myself. But one thing I will say about staying in the closet that long is that I like to say, well, you know, I gave it an old college try, so I just don't think that's where it came from. I mean, yeah, I just don't.
And again, getting personal, but you do write about it, is that the first sexual experience really just completely changes your world then.
Oh, I avoided it for so long, part of that staying in the closet, in part because I had a sneaking suspicion in my gut that there would be no turning back, that it was going to be impossible not to come out. And yes, it totally upended my world. It was like feeling my chest loosen up and relax when I hadn't even known how tight it was.
Mm. When you think of the case and the fact that a killer has been charged and then convicted of this crime, and how that relates to you, I mean, there will always be a link to a murder that you had nothing to do with.
Yes, absolutely.
And that seems odd, and yet, as you read the book, completely makes sense.
I appreciate that. Jeremy Guillory, the victim of Ricky's murder, the little boy whom Ricky Langley killed, was almost absent in the files. And that's something I really wrestled with throughout writing this book. Because I would read and read and read of Ricky Langley, but this little boy was missing. And it really made me think about what unknowable things Jeremy carried in his body. And that in some ways brought forth for me this question of the unknowable things that I carry in my body, the evidence that is kind of written into our bodies. So it's absolutely true. It was a murder that was completely unrelated to my life. And yet when I looked at it, I started to understand things about my own life. Mm-hmm. And as I said, I think that's something we all do. I think we interpret our lives through the lives of other people, and we interpret other people's lives through our own lives. And in a way, we are all connected in this story-making fashion as we try to understand each other and understand this world we live in.
We should note, you no longer practice law, which tells us a lot in and of itself, doesn't it?
I'm not sure what you mean by it tells us a lot. I might agree if I know what it tells us.
Well, that once you go through this process and you have the law affect you in this way, that you no longer look at it as what you want to do with your life, and you become a writer.
I have a lot of admiration for lawyers. I have a lot of admiration, so much admiration, for people fighting the good fight with the death penalty, against the death penalty. Ultimately, I decided that wasn't going to be my role. Because I have a hard time with making a simplified story. I mean, every story is in its way simplified. One of the things that was really important to me in the book was to show the seams of how I was making this story and try to acknowledge different paths at every step, to sort of interrogate the story-making process, even as I told the reader what I hope is a page-turning story, that I worked hard to make a page-turning story. Mm. But in a courtroom, what I want to talk about is the way that is a construction. I don't want to participate in the construction. I want to highlight the construction.
And did that understanding come as a result of this work on this case, in going through all of the documents and working this out for yourself?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And I now teach at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard in the Graduate Public Policy Program. And what I teach there has become this look at how narrative underlies policy. I'm starting to realize that this is something I'm very interested in, this question of how we make stories out of the past.
The name of the book is The Fact of a Body, A Murder and a Memoir. It is published by Flatiron Books. Alexandria Marzano-Lesnovich, I thank you very much for being with us. What a great pleasure to have you on the program.
It was a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We enjoy hearing from listeners about our show. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.